Chris Boyd. Each day on Think, we talk with world-class experts about a wide range of topics, everything from science and health to politics to how we can live better lives. It's all fertile ground for the rich discussions we like to have on the show. And we're always sure to talk with award-winning novelists, filmmakers, artists, and other creatives about their latest work. You can connect with us anytime via email. Our address is think@kera.org, or you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and stay up to date on upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Today's conversation starts after a short break. In the 17th century, philosopher Thomas Hobbes made it clear he was not impressed by his forebears. Life outside society, he assumed, would have been solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. But what might our hunter-gatherer ancestors think about our lives? Crowded, overworked, stressed out, and sexually repressed? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The rise of agriculture paved the way for the development of the world's great cities with all their wealth, convenience, and opportunity. And yet, there is no question that the way we live and work right now in a civilization rife with inequality, obligation, and aching discontent can make anybody long for the free and easy life of a forager living off the bounty of the land. Writer Christopher Ryan considers this in his new book, Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. He joins us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco to talk about it. Chris, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Great to be here.
How do we know what we know about ancient hunter-gatherers? Is most of that information extrapolated from observation of 20th and 21st century foraging societies?
A lot of it is, yes, in addition to first contact accounts from explorers throughout history, historical references to the colonial period, for example, where laws were passed prohibiting settlers from running away to live with the Indians. Benjamin Franklin wrote about this. Additionally, there's a lot of information that can be gleaned about our ancestors' lives from archaeological finds, particularly about things like nutrition and their sexual lives, as I wrote about in a previous book, Sex at Dawn.
So it's interesting. You said that there were laws preventing settlers from running away with Indians, with indigenous people. Missionaries, colonizers have found themselves over and over not only surprised that indigenous people who had the opportunity to choose whatever was considered modern life at the time of contact have rejected that, but that people who were living that modern life were really drawn to it.
Yeah, it's interesting how sort of universal it is that people who saw both types of both approaches to life, the sort of post-agricultural approach and the indigenous approach, generally choose the indigenous approach. And there are very few accounts, corroborated historical accounts of indigenous people choosing to live a so-called civilized life. So people who've seen both sides almost always opt for that side. In Civilized to Death, I write about people who were on the Beagle with Darwin, for example. There are three Fuegians who had been essentially kidnapped on a previous voyage and brought to England, the idea being to show them how great life was in England and then take them back to their people so they'd tell everybody, no, you should just join the British, do what they want. It's so great. And in fact, what happened was as soon as they got back to Tierra del Fuego, they immediately abandoned the huts and gardens and everything that had been set up for them. And Darwin writes about it in his journals. He was completely confused, as people tend to be. You know, there's a famous account of a Kung San man from the Kalahari Desert. And when the anthropologist was trying to explain to him how great farming was, he said, why should I farm when there are so many mongo nuts in the world? Hmm. They just don't understand why working for your living and living in a settled house and this whole system that we've established has very little appeal to them. And so I tried to explore that in this book and take a look at get a more informed cost-benefit analysis of civilization outside of the ubiquitous propaganda that we're constantly inundated with.
These societies, hunter-gatherer societies, tend to have an ethos of sharing and egalitarianism. How do they enforce that?
Well, as you say, it's actually the central organizing principle of hunter-gatherer existence. And I want to be clear, I'm not talking about noble savages here. I'm not saying that hunter-gatherers are somehow better people than we are. But it's important to understand that cooperation and mutual dependence is what allowed our ancestors to survive. That's why it's so important. In fact, anthropologists refer to hunter-gatherers as fiercely egalitarian. Not just egalitarian, but they defend this egalitarianism fiercely. And as you suggest, there are social mechanisms that are in place to ensure that no one gets into a position of trying to impose his or her will on the group. Mechanisms range from ridicule, just joking about someone getting, you know, too big for their britches. If that doesn't work, they might be taken aside and have a serious talk about why what they're doing is unacceptable. And of course, we need to remember hunter-gatherers are armed. They're all armed. They all know how to use their weapons very well. And someone can have a hunting accident quite easily. So what you find, it's sort of a world upside down from the world we're in now. In terms of the exercising of power, for example, someone doesn't become a leader by declaring themselves a leader or trying to convince other people to follow them. In fact, if someone expresses the desire to be in a position of leadership, they're immediately disqualified. They're considered ridiculous and potentially dangerous. A leader is someone that other people respect. That respect accrues, and it's an organic, sort of spontaneous process. A leader is someone that other people want to follow, not someone who attains power through one system or another.
What are the options for people who find themselves in some kind of intractable conflict when they live in a very small band of people?
Well, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Dunbar's number. Mm-hmm. Robin Dunbar is a biologist in the UK who found that about the maximum number of people that we can keep track of is around 150. That's what our brains appear to be adapted toward. So hunter-gatherer bands rarely number more than 150 people and generally quite a bit fewer than that, depending upon availability of resources and the environment. So these bands sort of, they're called fission-fusion is the term anthropologists use. So they come together, form larger groups, maybe seasonally when there's more food available, and then split up when there's less food available. People move in and out of these bands at will. So there might be a sexual relationship that draws you into another band, or a relative is sick and needs help, so you'll go and stay with that band for a while. But people can come and go freely. So if there's a personal conflict, it's very easy to get away from it. And also in these bands, it's important to understand it's like living in a very small town where reputational damage is very important. Hmm. Everyone knows what you've done. Everyone knows how you treat other people. So there's a very sort of intimate and powerful process by which your behavior is scrutinized and controlled because you want people to love you. That's what keeps you alive, is the respect and love of the people you live with, which is why today it's so devastating that so many of us live alone. I think it's about 25% of Americans live alone right now. And in this sort of fractured world where most of Americans that have been surveyed say they really have no one that they can confide in, mm-hmm. no one who has their back. And this is the number one factor that predicts longevity and life satisfaction, is whether or not you feel embedded in a community of loving people. That's more important than whether you smoke, how much you weigh, what your diet's like, etc. The number one factor is whether you feel that you're part of a community of loving people. And this is a reflection, very clear reflection of our prehistoric past.
You note that foraging cultures tend to have a highly developed sense of gratitude. How does that manifest itself in the kind of spirituality they practice as compared with people in more settled environments?
Well, you find in hunter-gatherer groups, which are generally animistic societies, shamanistic societies, the attitude toward the natural world and the spirit, the world, I guess the spiritual world would be considered part of the natural world because in an animistic society, water has spiritual content, the rocks have spirit, everything has a spiritual content. And the approach tends to be, as you said, one of gratitude, because these people are living in a world that provides everything they need. So they look, you know, a hunter-gatherer will look at her environment and see medicines and tools and plants that can be used for fiber to weave baskets and to make a shelter and to weave a hammock and all, it's all right there. It's as if, it's like, you know, living in a city where everything's free. You have a credit card with an unlimited ceiling and you never have to pay bills. That's the approach that they have to life. That's their understanding of the natural world. Of course, you have to work to make things of these materials, but it's all there for you. So they tend to have this sort of default gratitude toward the world and toward the spirits within that world because they provide. So it's sort of a providing mother, a nurturing mother feeling. And when you look at agriculturalists, it's all laid out in the Old Testament, right? This sort of vengeful, jealous, strange, capricious, angry God that wants you to work and tortures you. And in the book of Job, all this sort of crazy punishments, random punishments. So the relationship toward the natural world changes to one in which it's mistrusted. It requires work. Thou shalt eat by the sweat of thy brow. It becomes a much more sort of oppositional, struggling existence, which is the irony of that quote that you started with from Thomas Hobbes, saying that life before the state was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. I've been studying hunter-gatherers for 20 years, and my conclusion is that Hobbes got it exactly wrong. He was projecting his own experience. And of course, he knew nothing of hunter-gatherer life, centuries before anthropology or any serious study. So he was projecting his own fearful, very unstable, difficult conditions into the past and just assuming they must have been much worse.
Was that the start of what you call the narrative of perpetual progress?
Yes, I think the narrative of perpetual progress in one form or another has probably been around since the advent of agriculture and civilization shortly thereafter, which is probably around 10,000 years ago at its earliest point. Societies celebrate themselves. Like any other system, they tend to have self-reinforcing mechanisms. And so, you know, if you're in Texas, it's likely you think Texas is the best place in the world. And if you're in France, you probably think it's France. And I lived in Spain for years, and the Spanish are very happy to be Spanish. That's natural. And I think it's something that we see happening across historical epochs as well. People tend to think the time that they were born into is the best possible time. And so if you believe that where you are now is the best, then you must believe that it's always been getting better and better.
My guest is Christopher Ryan. We're talking about his new book, Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. This is Think. I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Christopher Ryan. His new book is Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. So, Chris, if the rise of agriculture meant tying us down to possessions and work schedules and stress and toil, how did it happen that farming arose in so many parts of the world and then spread virtually everywhere? Why did we stick with it?
That is a central question, very important question with a somewhat complex answer. In order to address that question in Civilized to Death, I told a story, a true story, about a Scottish man who was visiting Napa Valley with his family, and they scheduled a hot air balloon ride, early morning hot air balloon ride out over the vineyards. And they were setting up the balloon. The professionals were working setting up the balloon, and a breeze, a wind came and started to pull the balloon away. And this man jumped in to help. He grabbed the basket, and the anchor rope broke, and the balloon started to rise from the ground. All the professionals immediately let go, because people who work with balloons know that you never let both feet off the ground. But this man held on. He didn't know. He didn't know what was happening. And he rose and rose and rose until he couldn't hold on anymore, and he died, obviously. That, to me, is what happened with agriculture. Agriculture arose in different parts of the world independently at different times. And by looking at various evidence, particularly pollen. Scientists find pollen levels in lake beds and pond beds, so they can read what happened climactically at different historical periods. What we see is that in each of these areas, similar conditions preceded the advent of agriculture, which was an increase in rainfall and general vegetation, plant life, which means also animal life, would have increased in response to that abundance. Human population would have increased in response to the abundance. And then a sudden diminishment of the rainfall. So drought set in and a sudden decrease in that abundance. So generally what would have happened in the past is that human population would have gone down as well. People would have died of starvation. And but someone figured out that if we dug a trench from the river to that grove of fruit trees, the fruit trees don't die and there's more fruit. And so they sort of come up with this idea, wait a minute, we can inject ourselves into this sort of natural process and save lives. We can survive. They found a way. Some very clever woman or man found a way to manipulate nature a little bit so that we can save ourselves. That was a great idea, and it was similar, analogous to Ian Stevenson jumping in and grabbing the basket and trying to help. But that created a process, a ratcheting process, because as soon as that happened, then you have, in short order, you have hierarchies, political hierarchies that that emerge to decide who's going to decide who gets what, who's going to protect this land, who's going to sow the seeds, and who's going to take care of the animals that we can now domesticate because we've taken control of this process. All these, this whole suite, the whole catastrophe, if you will, of civilization starts to arise from this one small change, seemingly small change, but it's a point of no return because population starts to grow exponentially once that happens. You have the political hierarchies, as I mentioned, and because population is expanding so quickly, largely because women no longer have much control over their own reproductive capacities, meant the status of men and women alters from being quite equal in hunter-gatherer societies to women being reduced to possessions of men. All these things create an expansionist, militaristic, very aggressive society that humans are embedded within. So it's interesting because if, you know, it seems counterintuitive if I'm arguing that civilization may not be a net benefit for the average human being, which I believe to be the case. why is it so ubiquitous? Why is it so powerful? You know, and I think it's we see the same thing in the insect world. There are situations that happen with insects where there's a certain system of social insects that are very dominant, but that doesn't mean that the individuals within that species necessarily have a high quality of life.
So you mentioned that women in settled agricultural societies lost control over their reproductive capacities. People might be saying, what in the world is he talking about? This is long before birth control. But explain how foraging cultures would have affected the time periods between which women would be able to reproduce.
Sure. In hunter-gatherer societies, women tend to breastfeed for about 4 years. And while a woman is breastfeeding, particularly a hunter-gatherer woman who has very low body fat content, she is unlikely to ovulate. So she won't get pregnant again during those years. So if you count the 9 months she's pregnant and then the 4 years or so that she's breastfeeding, that's about 5 years between births. And then maybe it takes another year or so to become pregnant again. So you're looking at wide spaces between births. When agricultural societies arose with domesticated animals, babies could be weaned much earlier and shifted over to animal milk. And therefore, the woman would be able to become pregnant again much sooner. And that's what we see. And there's also the sort of impetus toward free labor, having more children. Is advantageous in an agricultural society, whereas in a foraging society, it isn't necessarily. We see forager population levels being quite stable for hundreds of thousands of years until agriculture, and then populations started to increase exponentially, as I said, and really haven't stopped. And that's not, you know, in one of the books that I sort of respond to in Civilized to Death by Matt Ridley, a book called The Rational Optimist, which is sort of the opposite argument to what I'm making in Civilized to Death. One of his first points is, you know, we're an incredibly successful species. Look at us. We went from maybe 50 million hunter-gatherers to 8 billion today. And I'm saying, how does that mean success? On what level is that success? There are far more chickens alive today than there were 100 years ago. Does that mean chickens are a successful species? Are chickens enjoying their lives more? I don't think so. So I think we need to, when we look at this question of the value, the ultimate value of civilization, I think we need to be very careful about what it is we're measuring. And for my money, what I want to measure is quality of life of the average individual alive. I don't think total number of us on the planet is a very good measure. And in fact, at this point, I think it's pretty clear that there are far too many of us and the planet can't handle it.
Certainly, there are too many of us to practice hunter-gatherer lifestyles again. If we all stopped agriculture, I mean, billions of people would starve, right?
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's that ratcheting process. Uh-huh. We're, you know, we can't let go at this point. But I do think that we're in a very important historical moment. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard of Joseph Campbell and read his great book, A Hero with a Thousand Faces, in which he explains that virtually every society in the world has the same origin myth. And that's the myth, the story, like in the Odyssey. It's the story of someone who goes out into the world, leaves their home, goes out and experiences challenges and near-death experiences and learns lessons and gains knowledge through this journey. And at some point then returns to where they began, returns home with what they learned in their voyage. And uses that knowledge to live properly for the first time. T.S. Eliot said, "We shall not cease our exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to return where we began and know the place for the first time." I feel that that's what our species may be doing. It feels to me that we're at a point in our development as a species where we're starting to turn back toward home. If you look at exercise, nutrition, so many aspects of medicine, sexuality, as I mentioned in a previous book, you look at our world today, and so many of us seem to be yearning to return home. And I would say home is a place that looks something like a hunter-gatherer existence, at least in the sense that, as I mentioned earlier, we're embedded in a community of people we trust and love. We help each other take care of kids. We take care of each other when we're old and infirm. These are very hunter-gatherer principles. If you look at the political landscape today, it sort of lends itself to an interpretation where there's one approach, maybe exemplified by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and that wing. They're quite hunter-gatherer. They're saying we should share, we should take care of each other, no one should be left behind. And then there's the other wing that says, no, this is all about individual property rights and this is mine and individual struggle. It's a debate that happens within us as individuals and within societies that I see exemplifies are we hunters or are we hunter-gatherers or are we farmers? It's an interesting approach.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, I want to go to the phones now. We have Jeremy calling from Dallas, Texas. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Thank you for having my call.
Sure.
I just finished reading Steven Pinker's Better Angels of Our Nature, which talks a lot about the decline of violence over the past, since pre-agricultural societies. And it was interesting that, one thing he mentioned was that there was a lot of infanticide, genocide in pre-agricultural societies, and just in general, I think some societies had as much as 40% death by some violent means in those times. And I'd just like to hear your guest take on violence and the role that it played in the time period he's talking about.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Yes, I disagree with Steven Pinker profoundly. I get into this explicitly in both my books, Sex at Dawn and Civilized to Death. Steven Pinker has done he draws his data from questionable sources, I think, in terms of his arguments about violence in hunter-gatherer societies. First of all, he calls horticulturalists hunter-gatherers, which is a serious mistake. Horticulturalist societies are those in which people have domesticated animals, settled villages and gardens. Our ancestors had none of those things, our hunter-gatherer ancestors. By definition, hunter-gatherers are immediate return. They eat what they find and they have no accumulated resources, which means that there's really nothing worth fighting over. There's nothing, they don't have any possessions that would be worth risking your life to raid and get. They also don't occupy one specific tract of land. So there's not this sort of fighting over land, fighting over this river, there's really very little to fight over. And as I mentioned earlier, because of fission-fusion social mechanisms, you tend to be surrounded by groups that you know that are friendly to you. So the world that Steven Pinker imagines existing in prehistory is not supported by my understanding of the research. And I cited, for example, a case where he talks about this very high rate of violence, and he uses a group in South America in the Amazon and talks about how many of their people were killed in conflict. But what he doesn't say is that they were killed by ranchers, loggers, and gold miners. So essentially they were murdered. And he cites that and says this is evidence of their violent nature or their violent lives. No, they're being invaded by so-called civilized forces. So it's a complicated question, and certainly the data is scant enough that it can be interpreted in different ways. But I think there's a lot of I think the evidence is pretty strong that hunter-gatherer societies actually weren't engaged in constant warfare, as Pinker and others have argued.
All right, let's talk about disease. Presumably, our hunter-gatherer ancestors had just a rudimentary knowledge of biology, but you say they probably didn't have most of the communicable diseases that circulate within the human population today.
Yeah, this is something that comes up quite often. People say, oh, but we have antibiotics, we have modern medicine, surely this is amazing. And of course, there are amazing things that we've learned in modern medicine. The problem is that most of the things that medicine is solving today or partially solving are problems that are a result of civilization. So you mentioned communicable diseases. Almost all of the major communicable diseases resulted from humans living in close proximity to domesticated animals. Tuberculosis came over from cattle. Chickenpox, smallpox came over from ducks and chickens. Influenza, other diseases came over from pigs. So these weren't issues when we were hunter-gatherers, when our ancestors didn't live in a farming area with lots of animals. None of these pathogens existed in human beings. Additionally, if I cite several different papers written by doctors who went and lived with hunter-gatherers and studied their health, you find no heart disease, no hypertension, no diabetes, etc. So a lot of the problems that are being solved by modern medicine are actually caused by civilization.
My guest is writer Christopher Ryan. His newest book is Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. Listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is writer Christopher Ryan. We're talking about his new book, Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. Chris, why would foraging societies be less hung up on the rules surrounding sexuality and relationships and reproduction?
Well, this is covered extensively in Sex at Dawn, my first book that I wrote with Casilda Jetta. They would be less hung up on it, I guess, from a logical perspective. There's lots of observational data and evidence coming from primates and various places. But as far as the motivation, I would say being less hung up on it would fit into a non-possessive approach to life in general. Hmm. Hunter-gatherers don't really have a sense of private property. Everything is shared. So when a hunter kills an animal, for example, brings it back to the group, the meat is shared. In fact, the hunter gets the least interesting parts of the animal. Generally, giving is honored much more than possessing. And it makes sense because if you're in a hunter-gatherer group like this, sharing mitigates risk. There's an expression I heard when I was in Africa, which is the best place to store extra food is in your friend's stomach.
Hmm.
And this makes perfect sense. It's a way of risk management. It's essentially an insurance policy because no hunter, no matter how good you are, no matter how rich the environment is, no hunter is successful all the time. In fact, very few times will a hunter be successful. But if 5 or 10 different people are out hunting in a given day, some of them are going to bring back something, probably. So everything is shared. Everybody eats. You have social cohesion. This interdependence is preserved. So why would you then be possessive about sexual relationships and pleasure? Children are raised communally. The children refer to all adult men as father, all adult women as mother. Most hunter-gatherer people have no idea that sex even causes pregnancy. So there are all sorts of evidence that we go through in Sex at Dawn for why this is the case, both in terms of establishing that it is in fact the case and then theorizing about why it functions better in hunter-gatherer societies that way.
How do foraging societies tend to view what we call in Western medicine a psychotic break, seeing visions, hearing voices, that sort of thing?
That's a very interesting question. It appears that psychosis or schizophrenia in particular appears to occur in about 1% of people worldwide, regardless of what culture they live in. And so we can probably surmise that it occurred with the same frequency in hunter-gatherers. The way they tend to view it is that someone who is hearing voices and sort of experiencing this fractured reality, that what's happening is that they have the capacity to move between worlds. But initially, when it first occurs, they don't know how to control that capacity. So they're helplessly being pulled between this consensus reality world that we're all in together and some other world where the spirits reside. And so they see this, the term used by people who study this is that they're called to shamanize, meaning the spirits are choosing them as an envoy between these two worlds. In Civilized to Death, I tell the story of Black Elk, which he recounts in a book called Black Elk Speaks, which is a classic of American Indian literature, which is essentially the story of a young man experiencing a psychotic break. And what his tribe does is the shaman sits down with this boy who was, I think, 13 or 14 at the time, and asked him to recount in great detail the vision that he had while he was unconscious for a couple of days. And so the boy tells the shaman this vision, which involved horsemen riding into the village from the four directions and different colored horses and women dancing and singing particular songs and very great detail. And then the shaman explains this vision to the tribe. And the tribe sit the boy down in the middle of the village and they enact his vision. Hmm. The whole tribe enacts this vision for him with the horses and the women chanting and singing and the whole thing. So what did this boy feel? I imagine what he felt was loved, supported, protected, honored even in his vision. Why would they do this? They did this because a shaman is a great resource for a society like this. Someone who can move between worlds is someone who can cure illnesses and go into the other world and access information that's not available here. So it made sense for them to try to help this boy to harness this energy, to learn how to move between worlds. And this is what we see all over the world. There are two types of shamans, those who choose to be a shaman and those who are called to be a shaman, and the latter form is a much more powerful and honored type of shaman. So it's totally the opposite of what we do in our world, where we consider these people sick and we isolate them and drug them and ignore them. And it's similar to what we do with our old people. Rather than honor them and exalt them and support them, we shunt them off, put them somewhere, and forget about them.
It would seem like a human universal that we are afraid of death. How do modern efforts to prevent dying end up causing more suffering?
Well, one of the questions I looked at in Civilized to Death is the question of human longevity, because you hear so often people, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will be thinking, hey, man, we've doubled the human lifespan. So say what you will about civilization, we're living twice as long, aren't we lucky? I taught in medical schools in Spain for a while, and doctors would say to me, but we've doubled the human lifespan. Or I quote a doctor in the book saying, of course we have chronic back problems. Our bodies weren't designed to live more than 35 or 40 years. This is totally wrong. Our species typically lives into our 60s, 70s, even later. The reason people think that we died at 35 is this statistical anomaly or statistical trick where a lot of children died, as your previous caller said, there was infanticide and there was a lot of child mortality. And so because of that, the average age of death could be 35 or 40 when you calculate that, include those infants and young children in the statistical average. But no one has ever been old at the age of 35 or 40. That's simply not the case. So it's the way we treat dying today in this sort of we've extended life a little bit, not a lot, but maybe 5 to 10 years since hunter-gatherer times, is essentially we slowed down the dying process. If you look at years of active, vigorous life, there's virtually no difference or there's a decrease between hunter-gatherers and modern Americans. And don't forget, we're talking, if we're comparing hunter-gatherers to Americans, we're talking about the richest society that's ever existed in the world. We're not even talking about African and Asian and various societies around the world that don't have anywhere near our access to medical care. So the argument I make in the book and the evidence that I've uncovered seems to say that we haven't actually extended life. What we've done is we've slowed down dying. And whether that's a good thing or not is very difficult to say. My father died about a year ago, and the last 4 or 5 years of his life were very difficult, were not enjoyable years. It was constant medical procedures and tests, and I finally had to call the doctor and just say, please let this man die. You're torturing him. This is not a good thing that we're doing. And I think a lot of people face that kind of situation in their final years.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We worry, I think, a lot of us, Chris, that a return to wildness would look something like Lord of the Flies, which has become, as you mentioned, like required reading in every middle school or high school. But a real-life version of Lord of the Flies actually happened. What was the outcome for those stranded children?
Yeah, they behaved precisely the opposite of what was depicted in the novel. They took care of one another. They coordinated to make sure somebody was always awake. They only traveled around the island in pairs. So if someone slipped or hurt themselves, they'd be taken care of. You know, that's just one example of many that I look at in the book, showing how what's predicted in human behavior under extreme conditions tends to be the opposite of what actually happens. There's a disaster sociology is this field of looking at how people behave in disasters. And, you know, the neo-Hobbesians would have us believe that once the sort of limits and authoritarian structures of civilization fall away, we become wild animals and tear each other apart and rape and pillage. But in fact, what happens is people revert to a hunter-gatherer approach and they help each other. In fact, the founder of disaster sociology, a man named Charles Fritz, said at the end of his career, what he had learned is that people who survive disasters tend to look at those years as the best times of their lives because they had a sense of purpose, of meaning, of community. They were interacting with people with love and compassion and kindness and generosity. And he said that his conclusion after a lifetime of studying these things was that the real disaster is the slow, subtle disaster of daily normal life in civilization.
We have an email here from Justin who wants to know what you think about the rise of these realistic role-playing video games about agriculture and agricultural society. Do they have an impact on the sort of propaganda that the best way to be is in a settled agricultural society?
Well, I have to be honest, I know very little about video games. I'm 57 years old. That whole thing happened after I was already onto other things. But the propaganda supporting agriculture is everywhere. It's in every medium. And it tends to be, you know, as I said earlier, it demonizes the natural world and overhypes the sort of civilizational world. And I think the net effect of that, and really the motivation for why I wanted to write this book, is that people don't understand why they feel discontent in the modern world. They're told everything. You've got everything you could possibly want. This is the best possible time to be alive. If you're unhappy and you're discontent, well, that's your fault. You're doing something wrong. There's something wrong with you. And what I'm trying to say is, no, if you're unhappy and discontent and you don't find this existence to be satisfying, that's because you're living in a world that's totally ill-suited to your nature as an animal.
But is there anything we can do about that?
Sure. I think there's a lot we can do about it. You know, what we can do, the first step, of course, is to have a deeper understanding of what kind of animal you are, what the world is that you came from, your species came from, and then tweak your life in ways that bring more of those elements into your world. So, for example, as I mentioned earlier, we're a deeply social species, and the greatest predictor of health and longevity is whether you feel embedded in a community of loving people. Look for that in your life. That's more important than a bigger house and another car and a fancier vacation. Try to be with people who love you and take care of you and do the same. If you're unhappy, the best thing you can do, and this is demonstrated time and again in psychological research, the best thing you can do is help someone else. Go volunteer somewhere. Give money to somebody who doesn't have it. Give your time and attention to someone who needs it. That will make you feel better, not in some karmic Buddhist sense, but just because that's the kind of animal you are and you're designed to respond to that. Unfortunately, the sort of impulses and the lessons that civilization tells us will make us happy actually tend to make us unhappy.
The new book by writer Christopher Ryan is Civilized to Death, The Price of Progress. Chris, it's been really interesting. Thanks so much for making time to spend with us.
I appreciate it.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. We hope that you will subscribe to the Think podcast, and you can learn about upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.